So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Since the beginning of time, people have dreamt of the unfathomable. The dreamers have turned into champions, and the champions to immortals. Tonight, WCW brings you the unimaginable. Two champions, 12-time WCW champion Ric Flair, and 5-time WWF champion Hulk Hogan. When these two worlds collide, a new universe will emerge with only one ruler, one champion. Live from Orlando, Florida, the match of the century, as WCW presents Back at the Beach.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, and I'm joined by Wei Ting. How are you doing, Wei?
I'm doing really well.
You know, tonight's edition of Review Away, it's brought to you by Combos.
Combo snacks.
Which you purchased and are sitting right here. They look disgusting.
Well, I have a pack of Combos. The discussion last week sparked much debate on the Facebook group. Many people agreeing with my analysis, my opinion of Combos, but many people disagreeing with my opinion of Combos. So later on in this show, John Pollock, you have never had these before.
I'm Combos not having one. I refuse to.
We will be giving John Pollock the final vote in our question. Do you like Combo snacks? And we'll let John Pollock be the ultimate deciding factor.
Well, I don't think I can really register a informed vote.
What do you mean?
I've never had these things, nor do I want to try them.
Well, you might keep
at the edge of your seat, everybody, and we'll see.
You might really enjoy it. You don't know. This is the zesty salsa flavor.
I'm getting like the vomit feeling in my stomach right now with them in the package.
Why? I don't know why.
They look disgusting. So that's coming up later, everybody. In addition to that, we are going to be joined by something you would put Combos into, the mouth of the South. Jimmy Hart will be joining us.
Good job.
That was pretty good.
You're clever.
He's going to be joining us to chat about the 1994 Bash at the Beach because Jimmy Hart was a huge part of this event and coming over to World Championship Wrestling alongside Hulk Hogan. And we'll be chatting with Jimmy about that whole time period and what was going on at the time and kind of how these two sides got together for this very landmark event with WCW signing their biggest star at the time, which contrary to popular belief, they always like to tout that they signed him away from the World Wrestling Federation. He had left the WWF a full year before this and had been working for New Japan Pro Wrestling. It wasn't exactly like they just scooped him out of the WWF, but that's kind of that was kind of always positioned with the WWF saying that they got raided,
and that's the public impression, right? Here you have the biggest star of the whole industry, a star that was synonymous with the WWF brand, so suddenly make his appearance in WCW. It was a game changer, and this show is the beginning of a new era, the Hulk Hogan era.
That is true. And this Jimmy Hart interview, it's going to be coming to you on Skype. And I thought, Wei, maybe you could just paint the picture for our listeners of this setup we've got here right now. Okay. I am looking at two computer screens, 4 microphones.
Yeah, so because...
I hate this studio.
Yeah, well, everybody is aware of the troubles we've been having with our phone and our call-in phone service offered here at the Fight Network Studios. They just don't work.
By don't work, let's elaborate, Wei. Outside of the skipping problem, which sometimes can be avoided with a reboot of the system, the current problem on top of that is that when we pick up the phone, the lines are crossed, and therefore we are getting a Chinese radio station in my ear, which, annoying enough that you have it in your ear. Typically, when lines are crossed, that doesn't bleed through into the recording. But thankfully, our studio is the exception to that rule because it does bleed through.
Oh, it does. Wow.
It's terrible.
That's awful.
So, yeah. My God.
So anyway, we've decided to just do all our interviews with Skype from now on, and that's why.
I called up Mark Zuckerberg. I'm like, make this shit happen.
Yes, and so in addition to our regular setup with our regular microphones, we brought in our own personal setup that we now use at home. So pretty much my laptop and then 2 microphones.
It's amazing. It's like we, in order to progress, we have it's like consumer based our studio. It's like we are supposedly in a professional studio.
Yeah, I know.
And it's the problem.
Yeah, I know. Maybe you could say the same thing about many things. The more resources, the more people get involved, the more money,
more headaches
involved. Yeah, maybe that's
more money, more problems.
Exactly.
March 9th, 1997, my birthday.
Yeah.
He died.
Yeah.
All right, Wei. Anything else you want to chat about? Anything fun this past week? I feel that listeners want to hear more.
Okay.
Specifically from you. Anything?
Let me think about that.
You purchased some combos?
No. Not
nothing.
I've been pretty much just cooped up.
Can you tell the story from last weekend at the barbecue with your... your carpooling?
Did you guys talk about this on Byte Radio?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
A little bit.
Well, for those of you who don't listen to Byte Radio, Jason Agnew and Justin Terry have their usual once-a-year summer barbecue.
Yes.
So last weekend, they just asked us to come, and then I, of course, asked one of my friends, Gordon.
Yes.
So he came with me before, and so he came with me this time. But this time, he asked if he could bring a few more guests because he has a couple cousins that are coming in from China, and they're immigrating here. But in the meantime, they're staying with him at his house. So they really told him last minute that they wanted to come, and so I was like, okay, sure, you guys just tag along. So they come here. And then I just kind of leave them alone. Like, we all have our burgers and, you know, they're drinking. And then we're just kind of talking and, I don't know, having a good time. Next thing I know, I see them walking down this driveway and they're just stumbling. And
Like walking right into the house.
Yeah.
Into the bricks. Like these two girls. It's like, like two high school girls that, like, are giggling and stuff in school, except these two were hammered.
Yeah, well, I mean, their ages were like, I think 20, 19, and then there was a guy that was 17. But they're 20 and 19. I figure that, you know, they've had drinks before. This is nothing new for them. No, this is their first time.
Different rules in China.
This is their first time getting drunk. I had no clue, and I don't know if Gordon knew either. So they were pretty much, they just went into Jay's house and they were passed out immediately. Gordon was there with like a bucket in case any of them hurled. This was like the UFC night too, so like eventually we all came in, like the whole party came
in. 25 people here in this living room as these two girls are passed out on the couch as we're yelling watching UFC.
Yeah.
I just couldn't fathom the culture shock of these, specifically of the guy who, here he is in this new country, in a stranger's home. His two sisters are passed out. Yeah. He cannot communicate because he doesn't speak any English. Watching these guys beat the shit out of each other on television.
He was enjoying it. He
it's
liked
like,
it.
This is his introduction to Canada.
Not a terrible introduction.
A mind fuck of a one, though.
This is what our country's about. But anyway,
girls didn't vomit. I was impressed.
No, they didn't. I offered to drive them home, but the thing that they were most terrified was that their parents would see him like this. So
that's amazing.
We waited it out.
That's amazing. Like
what?
At 20, being worried about your parents seeing you like
drunk.
It's very different, John.
It's very different.
Oh, I don't doubt it. Yeah. But I just, because you offered them a ride home at like 7:30, and they said no, we will stay here. I guess not in those words, but said you reiterated we're gonna be here till 2 a.m. If I was that fucked up, the last thing I'd want to do is be sitting in a strange house on a couch, knowing that I've got another 5 hours of this ahead of me.
Yeah, well,
so that's crazy.
It was that or the alternative, which is
I guess worse.
Get disowned.
Disowned.
No, I don't know.
So, you were a trooper that night, getting them home. They seemed okay by the end of the night.
Yeah.
It was amazing because for like the first like five fights, they were just out cold. And then come like 10 o'clock, they woke up and they seemed fine.
Yeah, I guess it just passed through.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. Well,
it emigrated out of them.
Nope.
But that was a fun story from last weekend, way.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, anytime you get to see people drink for the first time, especially excessively.
True.
And by excessively, we mean, two beers and a rocket they had each?
Two or three, yeah. Probably two.
Two beers.
Two. Well, I mean, they're girls.
They're tiny.
Yeah.
Asians.
Yes. That's right.
They didn't get red, though.
I think they did.
Didn't they?
Yeah. Anyway. Are we just going to talk about this? How was your weekend? What else did you do?
Well, I went to this barbecue on Saturday.
Aside from the barbecue.
I tried to play baseball with some friends on Sunday.
Oh.
Yeah. Thought I'd have like, 16, 18 people out. Seven came.
Seven people?
Yeah.
So how did you guys do that? How did you play?
Well, Tyler Warman hit the ball to the outfield and we caught it numerous times.
Oh, okay.
And then we rotated with people just hitting the ball around. And then I went with two of my friends from there. We decided to go get something to eat on Yonge Street. And there was a Puck and Wings. And then across the street, there was this new place called Crazy Wings with the Z backwards.
I've heard of that. That's in Korean town.
Yes, at like Yonge and Finch.
Yeah.
Don't go to Crazy Wings.
No.
They have one thing of wings. You can order a thing of six wings, but it's like just your typical, it's like set up like a Chinese food place.
Yeah.
But it's got wings as like an appetizer.
Oh, I know. I don't trust any of those. Like you go to an Asian restaurant for Asian food.
Exactly.
I don't go to an Asian restaurant for wings.
Yeah.
I go to a white person's place or a black person's place for wings.
Yeah. So, we made a mistake there. The food wasn't there. I got a chicken Caesar wrap, which, again, you don't buy at a Chinese food place.
No. Well, I think they might be Korean. They could be Chinese. What difference does it make?
That's very, very stereotypical. So I did that on Sunday.
Crazy Wings.
And then I had to go buy one of those tape deck converter deals for your iPod to play in your car.
Oh, okay.
So I got a new car.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I got rid of my 96 Nissan Sentra, and I now am a proud driver of a 2002 Maxima.
Okay, that's an
upgrade.
Again,
from the Nissan family.
Wow, okay. So, well, what happened to your old car? I'm curious to know.
Well, it's, my parents just didn't want the car anymore.
Yeah.
And they gave it to me. And then they said that, my sister was going to get a brand new car. And she would no longer need hers. And my dad said, well, we want to sell your car. I was like, well, why? I like my car. It's fine. But knowing in my head, I've probably got a year left of this thing. And it's that or I either took this hand-me-down or I'd probably have nothing in a year. Because
you get a free upgrade to a new six-year older car.
I like my car. This car is much wider. It's a bit longer.
Okay.
So I think you just, when you're driving a car, it's just like,
it's an extension of your body.
Oh, totally. Like, when I'm in my old car, I know exactly what spots I can fit into. I know what my car is capable of when I'm turning. I mean, the parking lot across the street here. I mean, you have to maneuver in between fucking postal trucks.
You'll get used to it, though. You'll get used to your
car. It's been okay thus far. But it's got air conditioning, though, which my old car didn't. It has power locks. A trunk that is usable.
I would always offer to drive, usually, just for that very reason.
You're not a fan of my car.
Not really. How much are your parents helping to sell that car for?
Well, funny story. They're having this construction done at their house, so I went up on Saturday to drop off the car and make the switch. And one of the guys who was, like, working on their... They're just, like, tearing up their carpets and stuff, started talking to my dad about this car. He's like, oh, really? It's for sale? And the guy wants to buy it.
How much?
$500.
Wow, okay.
It's a steal.
Yeah.
It still runs really, really well.
Yeah, it still runs, so...
I don't know how many kilometers is on it, though.
What, doesn't say?
The odometer broke about 2 years ago, so it stopped at 197, and I've driven quite a lot in those 2 years, but...
Okay.
Outside of that, I mean...
$500?
I had to replace the muffler a few times, but...
Yeah,
like two or three times, but you're going to go through mufflers on cars.
Sure, $500, why not? Why not?
All right, Wei, I think it's time that we talk about some wrestling.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I didn't see any movies this week. Bash at the Beach, 1994, July the 17th, 1994, Wei.
July the 17th, 1994.
Yes.
Trying to think what I did back then.
We were 10.
Yeah. I think I took a summer trip. I took a summer vacation to Los Angeles with my mom, actually.
To L.A., really?
Yeah. I went to Disneyland. I was probably at Disneyland during this.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
If only she had taken you to, like, Disney World, you could have gone to this event.
That's true. Well,
Mom.
You messed up.
She should have been getting the Observer.
Yes.
She would have been aware then.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's weird that July 17th, that is the date of Money in the Bank next week.
You and your dates. You have a gift.
I know.
You certainly do.
I know.
I mean it. I'm not even being sarcastic.
Is it a gift, though? It's like, what good is knowing what day of the week?
This job. Doing this. You can be an archivist.
This is not a gift. It's a quirk. It's a, like someone that's like double jointed and can do weird shit. There's nothing you can get out of it.
No, there's a use for
those people. If there was a game show where it was based around knowing days of the week, what day was March 25th of 2002?
Which was?
A Monday.
Whoa.
I would.
How do you do that? How do you do that? Let me double check that. What was the date that you said?
March 25th, 2002.
March 25th, 2002.
But my point is, there's no... It's a, ooh, that's kind of cool. That's the reaction. And that's it. I can't make money off this gift.
That's where you have to learn. Holy shit, you're right. I can't believe that. I'm always amazed.
All right. Let's get into the pay-per-view, eh? They open up with a video talking about the unthinkable and two worlds colliding and a new universe prevailing. No subtlety on this at all. This was the biggest of the big.
I thought I was reading a comic book.
Two worlds collide, a new universe prevails.
Yeah.
And it says there will be one champion and one ruler. The match of the century between Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan. Now, people can say what they will about WCW and some of their choices, but... they promoted this match in this one video better than... like, WWF had this match 2 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
3 years. It was 91. And they sent it out on the house shows, didn't draw to what they expected, and they ditched it from WrestleMania in 92.
Yeah.
And look what WCW built this up as this dream match.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't even matter that WWF had done this match years earlier.
Well, they did it at house shows, but did they do
it
on TV?
The national audience had not seen it.
No.
But it was just amazing that the WWF just gave up on this.
They handed them this gift, basically.
And WCW did a very, very smart job building this up. And your announcers were Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan, and they start off the show where they are joined by Gene Okerlund. And Heenan is upset that Hogan is coming in. They announced that Shaquille O'Neal will be handing the title to the winner, and Mr. T will be in the corner of Hulk Hogan. Now, Mr. T, by 94, little past his...
What was he doing?
I don't know.
I don't either. But yeah, the A team.
He was part of the B team by this point. Fake laugh.
No, that was...
But Shaquille O'Neal in Orlando. Great coup for them.
Oh, it's a huge deal.
Yeah. So
Shaq.
He had only been drafted in what, like 92? Like he was pretty young by this
Something like that. But I think even within that time he was exploding in terms of popularity.
Yeah.
He had action figures and
I think he had the same management as Hulk Hogan. I think they were all
really
managed by Henry Holmes, but I could be mistaken.
Wow.
They might have just been acquaintances.
Okay. Shaq Fu was
Shaq
to come
Fu,
out.
I had that game on Sega Genesis. It was such an easy game. I was kind of let down because it was like...
Why did you buy it?
I got it as a birthday gift, from a friend.
You're excused.
But nonetheless, I enjoyed it, though. I'm not going to lie. I thought it was fun. Okay. Then they show a video of Sting being injured the previous week at WCW Saturday Night, and he will not be able to compete on the pay-per-view. So they did not announce this prior. They waited till the pay-per-view started.
Hmm.
It's a pet peeve of mine.
Do you know the reason behind this?
I don't know. He could have legitimately been injured for all I know.
Okay.
And they show Sting putting Flair in the Scorpion Deathlock on that episode of Saturday Night, and a fan runs in dressed up as a man, and it turns out it is Sensuous, not Sensational. Sensuous Sherry, and rakes the eyes of Sting until Hogan makes the save, and it leads to Flair attacking the right knee of Hogan, and then Mr. T runs down, and the crowd was very much into this angle on Saturday Night. And this was probably Hogan's first appearance on television for the company, which was smart, just having him appear, get a rating, but the real in-ring debut would be at the pay-per-view.
Yeah, and they on that TV taping, they immediately linked him with Flair and had a little in-ring interaction.
But Sting here, I mean, the storyline reason is that Sherry raked his eyes and scratched the cornea.
Uh-huh.
What was the point?
So he can work some type of eye patch gimmick?
It's like, why don't you have someone take him out that he can work a program with when he comes back?
Yeah. Well,
and to me, it was just it. This seemed like it was Sting legitimately injured himself after this, and they had to go back to the tape and find a plausible out.
Huh?
Because it's not a typical wrestling injury angle, the eye rake spot.
Why?
I mean, you see it in every match in the mid-90s.
Okay, but I totally buy it. I buy a scratch cornea as just as much as a broken arm.
Okay,
and maybe they just wanted to link him with Flair.
Okay, so this was on WCW Saturday Night, and Okerlund then says that as of 5:30 p.m. today, officials ruled Sting could not compete with a scratch cornea. And then Schiavone says, well, it's time to bang heads, as his way to say, let's get to the action. It's time to bang heads.
Sure.
And the first headbangers were Steven Regal, accompanied by Sir William, better known to Memphis wrestling fans as Bill Dundee.
Oh,
Superstar Bill Dundee.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. And he's defending his television title against Johnny B. Bad. Mm-hmm. Johnny B. Bad.
Yep.
And Bad comes out with a robe that reads on the back, when you're hot, you're hot.
Well, he was...
That t-shirt never took off.
No. Regal just looked so young here. Looked like a little fresh-faced little
How
boy.
How old would Darren Matthews be now? Like 45, which would mean he would have been about... he would have been like 28, 29,
something like that. Yeah, he is now 43.
Oh, 43. So he would have been. Yeah, he would have been our age.
Yeah.
This point.
It's amazing. Okay.
And Bobby Heenan notes that you could watch the whole Gulf War on CNN, and you're going to see another war tonight in the main event.
Yeah.
Some nice Turner synergy there, everybody. And then there's confetti all over the mat for Johnny B. Bad. Oh, son of a bitch. And what happened after that? Way I gotta reload my notes.
Well, the match took place, John.
And that would happen.
In this match, we saw lots of typical Steven Regal style chain wrestling. Just really, really good European style exchange of holds. And I was quite impressed with Johnny B. Bad. He was able to keep up with Regal.
Johnny B. Bad gets a bad rap because I think a lot of people just looked at him as like this, not a musclehead, but you know, a bodybuilder, much more than a wrestler. And if he was in with the right opponent, he could certainly be carried and hold his own when he was in there with the right guy. Like, he had some really good matches that we've profiled here with Diamond Dallas Page.
Yeah.
I thought this was a pretty good match here. Certainly, I categorized Bad as a Putski candidate, though.
Sure.
He was ripped in this match. Holy crap. Like 5% body fat, I would guess.
Okay. Yeah. And honestly, didn't stand out too much to me. To me, he just looked like an average.
He was also next to William Regal, who, if he told me he had never done steroids, I would legitimately believe it, except he did get popped a few years ago.
Yeah.
For something that it sounds like it was a legitimate, he's always protested that he took something that he didn't realize the contents of.
Okay. Sure.
Which is a typical excuse you get in wrestling. But
yeah.
Regal's also the type that has owned up to his fuck-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's that that's where honesty comes into the equation, where if a guy is consistently honest with you and then comes out with an excuse, you give him the benefit of the doubt.
Mm.
Whereas someone like Kurt Angle, if this guy legitimately got fucked over and tested positive for something, you know, you look at some of his statements he's made.
Yeah.
I don't know how this got into a debate about honesty, but nonetheless, body types. So a very slow pace. There was a cool spot here where we saw a monkey flip by Regal as he kept hold of a Greco-Roman knuckle lock and then rolled over for a pinfall. Some really good chain wrestling here earlier from Regal. Slow pace. There were a series of arm drags by Bad. And then Johnny B. Bad spins Regal onto his left shoulder, and Regal sold this like someone had shot a bullet into his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
This was awesome.
Yep.
He sold this the whole rest of the match.
Yep. Yep.
Just this simple landing on your shoulder. And for the rest of it, he's selling the left shoulder. He's only working with the right arm.
Yeah.
And Regal comes back later with a right European uppercut. Heenan then here is talking about how he was recently filming a movie in Los Angeles and that the celebrities are talking not just about Hulk Hogan, but the celebrities are talking about Vader, the Guardian Angel, stunning Steve Austin and Ricky Steamboat. And then Schiavone notes, wrestling is cool again.
That was his tag. That was like his new catchphrase. He ended the show with that.
Well, Heenan then ends, compliments that one with, let WCW put a hold on you.
Oh.
This was like,
there's nothing.
Horrible branding campaign.
It's like, I know. It's like, the moment you say, you try to tell your audience that something is cool, it means it's really not cool. Like, listen to Review Away. We're really cool.
Now. Like, what does that say about our previous shows? If we're cool again, man, were we shit in the bed last year, folks.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay.
It was the 90s. Maybe cool was like the new thing.
It was the new heavy.
Or extreme.
What was the precursor to cool?
What'd
they use in Back to the Future a lot?
Awesome.
They used heavy.
Heavy? Okay.
But heavy and cool were kind of different.
Tubular.
Tubular. Rad?
Okay, let's stop. Let's move on.
Anyway, Johnny B. Bad continues to work on the arm. He takes a headbutt from Regal. Then they show Chris Lemon.
Who?
Yep, that's what I thought. He was one of the co-stars of Thunder in Paradise, who they show in the crowd. And he was such a big deal that he had seats way back.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of celebrities at this show.
This guy was not a celebrity. Why don't you look up Chris Lemon while I finish this up?
Sure.
Let's see what he's done. Bad then hits him with a big left and then hits a pescado to the floor. Crowd was hot for that. And then Johnny B. Bad goes for a sunset flip after the referee kicks Regal's hands because they were on the ropes. And then Regal reverses it, gets on top, and holds down Bad's legs and gets the pin and keeps the television title. And then after the match, Johnny B. Bad got his heat back by decking Sir William and throwing away his top hat.
Chris Lemon, I guess he hasn't really been too active in recent years, but he was in such hits as Airport 77, Cannonball Run 2, and Dad. So
Dad.
Yeah. 1989.
Dad.
With Ted Danson. and Ethan Hawke.
See, I was confusing that. That's weird because there was a...
Oh, is he Jack Lemmon's son?
No way. He's Jack Lemmon's son?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's why he got cast in these roles.
That's right. Yeah, he's Jack Lemmon's son.
Oh, nepotism. So I was going to say there was this movie I remember seeing with Macaulay Culkin and Ted Danson calling Getting Even with Dad.
Okay, well...
I saw that in the theater.
I don't think that was that one. Anyway, I really enjoyed this match, and I think this is the type of match that really showcases just how good of a technical wrestler Steven Regal is. There are just so many little nuances, like you mentioned, you know, the selling of the shoulder, that I don't know how much it actually matters to your typical audience, but for anybody who actually is studying the art of wrestling and obviously wrestlers that he's gone on to influence later on in the future, you can look at a match like this and just see how good this guy was.
Yeah. Fantastic stuff from Regal. And, I mean, at this point in time, too, he got to work with a lot of quality guys like Steamboat and Austin. And you had a really good mid-card at this time in WCW in that early 90s period.
Mm-hmm.
Then Gene Okerlund is in the ring, and he introduces a great wrestler and a great human being, the equivalent of a senator. It's like, we gotta speak to the American audience here, because they won't know what the Japanese diet is.
Diet.
And, is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
I've always heard the diet. But I'm Canadian. There it is. I'm not Asian.
Yeah, well, I could be wrong.
Diet.
I'm not Asian either.
W.H. Park, who I'm going to mention, everyone, he's going to join us next week.
Oh.
He's going to the Differeriok show for Pro Wrestling NOAH. It's like their big show of this tour, and he's going to come on with us via Skype.
Yes, that's right. He's all settled in Japan now.
Yeah, so we're going to chat with him about the transition over there. We'll chat with him about the Differeriok show. The we're just trying to work out a time, because very awkward when it's 13 hours difference.
Yeah, yeah, well...
Yeah. I was having a talk with somebody on the weekend about, they were like, what's the one place you'd want to go? And I said, Japan. I really want to go to Japan, but it's the fucking flight that I cannot it's 27 there?
27 hours? No. It's like, it's not that long. It's like, I'd say it's about maybe 12.
Oh.
Yeah. Not that bad at all. Maybe you're thinking of like Australia or, I don't even think Australia takes that long.
Australia's quite a bit. Well, I just... the WWE crew that just went to South Africa, that was like 27 hours, well, they said. But they had to change over. And shit.
South Africa is nowhere near Japan. That's Africa. Japan is in Asia.
Well, it's a long flight no matter which way around you're going.
They're completely opposite directions.
Yeah, but the difference from North America to Africa and North America to Asia...
Oh, it's quite different.
I think they'd be at least not a...
Well, to go to South Africa, I'm pretty sure you'd have to change flights. From Canada to North America to Japan, I think it's...
You
could take direct, yeah.
Direct, eh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, we should get you a map, John.
I understand. I'm just saying, from North America to Asia, though, that's a long distance.
Not the longest.
There's an ocean in between it.
Yeah. So, I honestly, anytime I go, I just sleep on the plane. I end up sleeping like I get 8 hours of sleep right on the plane.
Do you take drugs to knock yourself out? Or
no,
you just go?
I've always been good. Like I can.
You can sleep in some like in a car, man. You just you put your jacket over top of you and you're out.
I find it to be quite soothing. You know. Quite relaxing. You kind of get those gentle vibrations, and then just a lot of white noise with the air conditioning. I find it to be a great place.
I can't do it at all.
Really, huh?
Japan. Right, Inoki. That's what we were talking about. He came all the way over a 50-hour plane ride to receive a plaque. Yeah. And shoot an angle.
Yeah, that's right. What was the deal with Inoki at this time?
Well, New Japan and WCW had a relationship. This could have actually been, this would have been years into it. Like, they had always had, like, a lot of back and forth. Like, they had Tatsumi Fujinami come over for the pay-per-view in 91. They had always gone back and forth with Chono, with Muda.
Okay.
And this was just kind of an extension of that, where Inoki, he actually ended up, I believe, working one or two matches with Regal.
Wow.
Which, for Regal, must have been, like, the highlight of his life at this point, getting to work with Inoki.
And it really showed that the faith that the company had behind someone like Regal.
Yeah. And Regal came back into the ring, cuts a promo on Inoki, says he deserves an award over Inoki. And Regal says, Inoki isn't that big of a deal. And Inoki was just like, this just exemplifies the charisma of this man. Like, didn't say a fucking word. And he just built up looking irate. And by the time he took off his blazer, crowd was going crazy for this guy.
Yeah.
Like, just tremendous physical charisma. And that's what Inoki always got over on. And Regal then leaves and he calls Inoki lucky. And then he just said this. I don't know what it is, but things are just funny when they're not intended to be heard. And it's like when you and I will have a conversation that we end up putting in the podcast where we're not speaking directly into the mic, but it's just infinitely more funny because you feel like you heard something that you shouldn't have.
Yes.
And Regal's leaving here and he just goes to Sir William as the camera isn't even on him. There's no mic. And he's just like under his breath, I'm sick of these so-called bloody legends. And he just said this line in such a way that I thought it was just great. Huh. And it was probably an accident.
Yeah.
But just the way it was picked up, maybe. I enjoyed it a lot. I want to see this match by the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. It felt real.
I want to see Regal carry a however old Antonio Inoki at his age. And I think they ended up doing it on like TV or something.
Really?
Wow. If I'm not mistaken. I was not watching WCW at this point in my life, so I am not as nuts when it comes to factoids and shit. So that's what we get there. Then, oh, this drove me fucking nuts, okay? I had the home video of the great of Bash at the Beach. So I'm watching this, and it would just be like, match, transition, match.
They cut
it's
out
like,
every-
I know they're cutting out little shit, but then I found it online, and I'm just looking, I was looking up the time of the last match or something, and then I look under, and it's like, Big Van Vader versus Guardian Angel. I'm like, wait a minute. That match was edited right off of this. So I watched the rest of this on YouTube. They cut the shit out of this. And you were right from our discussion. The home video was actually under 2 hours.
Mm.
So I guess it was an SP they recorded in and had to... But like, fuck, this was annoying.
Sure.
That would drive me nuts if I bought the home video. Mm-hmm. And then it's not like... On the back of the video, they list what is on. It's just like a paragraph about Flair and Hogan. You don't know what's on this.
Probably for
and
that
it's
very,
like you get this shit version of the pay-per-view.
Probably for that very reason. They don't want you to know that, you know, what they cut out. But I'm sure back then this was the norm. They were just chopping
I hate
down.
Stuff being cut out.
Yeah.
Like, WWF didn't cut stuff out of their home videos.
Oh, is that right?
They put in all those... Dude, they took out, like, Flair's promo, but all the promos were gone.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, this was just odd.
Maybe they just wanted to save costs. Just buy some
Well,
tapes.
Fuck, if you're bringing in Hulk Hogan, but you can't fucking put together a 3-hour home video of his debut, come on.
Yeah.
So, at this point, I had to splice notes together. I had to go back and watch stuff to get the entire event. Tony Schiavone then welcomes Jesse Ventura by saying, "Turn around, Jesse, you're on camera." And Ventura looks at the camera. Oh, my God. If ever, you know, Jesse Ventura is, when he's on. But when he's off, he is off. Mm. And WCW, for the majority, man, was he mailing it in.
Seemed like it.
He just joins the commentary to replace Heenan for fucking two matches.
Mm-hmm.
This was around the time Ventura was, he was, at this point, I believe the mayor of Brooklyn Park, so it's not like this was his full-time job in WCW, and he was shortly going to be replaced full-time by Heenan. And I can't say that was a wrong choice based on the work on this show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we go to Big Van Vader, who's accompanied by Harley Race, taking on the Guardian Angel. And I never knew how the Guardian Angel gimmick came to be. As I said, wasn't watching WCW at this point, and they talk about an angle on television where... they constantly refer to the Guardian Angel as the man who stands for law and order. In other words, the man who was slapped with a cease and desist probably from the WWF to resemble a police officer. So they did an angle where Nick Bockwinkel on television, the commissioner of WCW at the time, took away his nightstick and handcuffs. And it just so happened that at the same television taping, members of the Guardian Angels were in the crowd. Big Boss Man met with them, and he became a Guardian Angel himself.
Mm-hmm. They trained him to fight without weapons. Now he's a Guardian Angel.
And do you know which future WCW performer ended up working with the Guardian Angels.
No.
Vampiro.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
But why? I mean, obviously they want to get through the boss man character, but why go with the Guardian Angels? Why not the soldier or the security guard?
Maybe the Guardian Angels were hip at this point. I remember seeing
what? Seriously?
I remember seeing I know I say I don't watch WWE, but I would flip through at times and at least it would come across and there was wrestling and you'd recognize the guy that used to be big boss man. I remember seeing some vignettes where they were on the street and they were helping people throw their garbage out into garbage trucks and just doing this lame stuff.
Is there a less intimidating name than the Guardian Angel?
The Dream Catcher. I don't know.
Okay.
Whatever. WCW and their gimmicks were more missed than hit.
Yeah.
So the match starts off. Vader delivers shots to the ribs of the Guardian Angel, who I'm sure I'll refer to as Boss Man during this match. We see a suplex by the Angel, and then he unmasks Vader, leads to a body slam. They show Hank Aaron, Antonio Inoki, and Bill Shaw, who was the executive producer of WCW at the time, in the audience. Then they fight to the floor. Big Boss Man drops Harley Race, and it leads to Vader attacking him from behind. Then we see a huge avalanche splash in mid-ring by Vader. Vader then applies this really shitty-looking leg submission.
I think he was going for almost an STF, but without the crossface.
Yes. So it was there was no pressure on the leg. It just looked really sloppy. And Shivani brings up, Vader works in Japan. And therefore, he knows these moves.
These weird moves.
Japan, they know how to break your legs. Guardian Angel then delivers a brief set of punches, but Vader puts him down, hits the Vader bomb, climbs up for another, then decides to go to the top rope and hits a moonsault. And this was botched here because I think Guardian Angel was supposed to get his knees up, but he didn't.
Oh my God.
But Vader sold it like he did.
Either way, that sounds crazy. Even to get your knees up for a moonsault from a guy that as big as Vader?
Pounds.
That's insane. So anyway, he landed. To take the moonsault probably would have been better. For your knees.
Yeah. Harley Race then climbs to the top rope, and he's tossed off the top like the flare bump. And then, first of all, I just want to say here, this was 94, so this was 16 years ago. And
17.
Yeah. Harley Race taking these bumps at this age, however old he was at the time, man, I just couldn't help but think of Harley Race getting around at Cauliflower Alley Club last year. He can stand up, but he pretty much gets around on on one of those motorized walkers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was just man, his hip is probably shot, his knees are probably shot, and you just watch bumps like this that he was taking at this stage of his career.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was not easy with his body. And then Vader gets clotheslined over the top rope, and then Guardian Angel throws Harley Race into the post and then delivers a vertical suplex to Vader into the ring. Now, that sounded like a normal sequence. However, WCW at the time had this ruling that sending someone over the top rope was a disqualification. This was a rule, I believe, implemented when Bill Watts was booking the promotion. And Shivani brought up this stipulation on the pay-per-view. So I want to count how many times they blatantly violated this. And this was number one. Okay? Guardian Angel should have been disqualified right there for the clothesline. Then a shoulder block sends Vader into the referee, and Harley Race passes a nightstick to Vader. And then Guardian Angel delivers punches, grabs the nightstick. The referee regains consciousness, sees Guardian Angel holding the nightstick. Before he even can hit him, the ref calls for disqualification.
Yeah.
Can you disqualify someone for just holding it? He didn't use it.
Yeah.
Maybe he was using it as an intimidation tool.
Yeah, okay, sure. I mean, this has always been an inconsistency in professional wrestling when referees would disqualify somebody just for holding it, but okay, whatever. Who cares? This was actually, I thought, an okay match, and despite the shitty gimmick, the crowd was really behind
the crowd was pretty hot for the show overall.
Yeah.
I wasn't crazy about the match. It was what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go to Jesse Ventura with Shivani. Shivani asks him his pick for tonight, And Ventura, just like so uninterested here, just says, I already gave my thoughts. I think Ric Flair will win.
Hmm.
Wow. That's why you're the analyst, Jesse. Thank you. Just like praying for Heenan to come back at this point. They show Chris Cruz and Mike Tenay backstage trying to get interviews for the hotline. The hotline way.
Yeah.
That was the way to get to, that was the internet back then.
Mm-hmm.
You realize if we were doing this in 94, we'd have a hotline instead of a podcast.
Sure.
And people, we'd be making 99 cents a minute.
Wow.
Seems like a much better idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot more than what we make now.
I want to send an email to Combos and see if they'll sponsor our podcast.
All right, okay.
Sure. Do you think do they have like a bigger label, or are they their own? Is Nestle or someone behind them? Or
the back of this package, Mars Snack Foods.
Oh, that's pretty big.
Hackettstown. I don't know if it's the same Mars. Could be. Official partner of NASCAR. So
official sponsor of NASCAR. Oh my God, yeah. Combos is probably doing well then.
Yeah, it is Mars. There you go. Okay, well, you give them a shout.
Then we show highlights of they show a video on the feud between Terry Funk and Dustin Rhodes, and Funk cutting a promo at Slamboree about how he's never going to leave, and if ever there was a more honest promo, this was it. Terry Funk saying, I'm never going to leave. Yeah. And there were some great promos here from Arn Anderson agreeing to team with Dustin Rhodes. It was this big build-up to Arn agreeing to team with him. So later on, we were going to get Arn Anderson and Dustin Rhodes against Terry Funk and Bunkhouse Buck. Still one of my favorite wrestling names.
Bunkhouse Buck, who played Jack Swagger Sr. last year.
That's right. That's right. Then they show highlights of some radio personalities from earlier in the show, Dark Match, that Jimmy Hart was refereeing. It was a... the guys from the Ron and Ron radio show, and I believe they were called
the Sassy Boys.
The Sassy Boys, and there was a girl in here who was maybe their call screener.
Molly McShane.
God, you paid way more attention to this than me. Molly McShane.
I believe isn't Molly McShane a former wrestler?
I have no clue.
Glory.
Glory.
Yeah, Glory.
That was her name, or that was the promotion?
What?
I mean, maybe for Glow?
Veteran of the Squared Circle returns after a brief hiatus from the ring in the late 90s. Molly McShane has returned to act. Oh, she's wrestling for a company named Glory. Anyway, she is Molly McShane, wrestler, female wrestler.
I would have loved to have seen this whole match.
I would have too.
It looked pretty poor.
Yeah.
Then we go to Funk and Buck, accompanied by Colonel Parker and Ming, to take on Dustin Rhodes and Arn Anderson. And Ventura brings up the Funk Rhodes family feud dating back to Dusty and Terry. Bunkhouse Buck, his ring attire consisted of like this tight white long sleeve shirt with suspenders, tight blue jeans, and black cowboy boots. This guy looked right out of Deliverance. Rhodes and Buck have a back and forth spot early on. Rhodes tosses Buck over the top rope. Referee doesn't see it, and Ventura flips. At least Ventura acknowledges this, saying that Tony gets upset when the heels do this, but when the baby faces do it, you don't care. So this was another instance, but at least they brought attention to it, which is more than I can say for future infractions of the law. Rhodes then misses a mid-ring crossbody, and he flies to the floor, and... You see, in WCW at the time, they had the steps in the middle where you would walk up to the ring. So when guys would take bumps to the floor, they'd hit these steps on the way down.
Mm.
Not so nice.
No.
So you had to get more distance if you want to clear the steps. Then the heels work over Rhodes for the heat. Buck has a front guillotine on in the heels corner. Then Rhodes makes a comeback. He knocks Colonel Parker off the apron, finally makes the hot tag to Anderson, and they react very big to Anderson finally getting tagged in. And then Arn Anderson DDTs Dustin Rhodes, puts Funk on top for the win, and the heels defeat Dustin Rhodes, and Arn Anderson joins the stud stable with the crew.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I thought Arn was just so much fun to watch from the apron the whole time. You can watch him like just exaggeratingly cheering for Rhodes. He's just a very animated guy.
They did this like almost similar finish to that... the Halloween Havoc 95 we reviewed, where it was the same deal, where Sting and Ric Flair joined up after Sting said, don't screw me like you've screwed me in the past.
Yeah.
And then Flair showed up, and he waited, and he waited, and he waited for the hot tag, finally got it, and then beat the shit out of Sting.
They've done this a number of times. They remember Buff Bagwell teaming up with Rick Steiner?
Oh, back when they could have actually pushed Buff Bagwell as a babyface after he broke his neck.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it... I thought in this case it worked well.
Yeah, sure. I know, well, Arn
is a babyface, just doesn't work for
him. And I found, like, his promos, like, I think he could probably sell, you know, anything. So, the promo adds a lot, and, yeah, this was fine.
The heels attacked the arm of Dustin Rhodes after the match, and then WCW officials Doug Dillinger and Greg Gagne run in to break things up. And the storyline here was that Rhodes broke his arm here and would presumably lead to Arn and Dustin down the road. Gene Okerlund then tries to interview Anderson, calls it one of the most disgusting and despicable things that Gene Okerlund has ever seen. Ever.
Ever.
Ever. You turned on your partner.
Mm-hmm.
Then Anderson says that they're celebrating tonight and they're going to have a party, and they invite Okerlund. Schiavone and Heenan are then with Hank Aaron, and Hank Aaron says, I'm pulling for both Hogan and Flair. Heenan says, you must be running for president in 4 years. Even though the next federal election would have been 2 years after this.
Oh.
And then Heenan calls him a so-so hitter, and then they discuss Dustin having a broken arm. Okerlund's backstage with Ric Flair and Sherry. Flair says that he and Hogan, they want it to be big, sold out, with big dignitaries on hand. And Sherry says that Flair has always been the man, and tonight Hogan is the challenger.
Mm-hmm.
Really good promo from these two, especially Sherry as well.
Sherry was good as well, yes.
I like these two together.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she was just nuts. And he was nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And together they formed a good little unit.
Yeah.
Bobby Heenan is then back on commentary, so we got Ventura for all of two matches, which he didn't really blow me away in those matches, so I didn't really mind. But I just question why even bring him in for the pay-per-view?
I don't know. What did Heenan say that he went into the back for?
I don't know. I don't think they even explained it. Jesse Ventura is here. Hey, you're on camera. Next up, we've got Steve Austin defending the United States title against Ricky Steamboat. I'm sure all of you are aware that Steve Austin is a former U.S. champion because Michael Cole announces the former champions every single U.S. title match and includes Austin every single time.
Sure.
Austin has a Dragon Slayer written on his tights.
Yeah. There's some backstory here that they were talking about how when Austin was the TV champion, it was Steamboat that ended his reign. So the story is Steamboat is trying to end his U.S. title reign as well.
What a simple story.
Yeah.
Very good. Austin drop kicks Steamboat and then is hanging over the top rope. Sorry. Austin gets drop kicked, and then he's hanging over the top rope to the outside with his legs caught on the top rope. Steamboat attacks him with punches from the floor. Austin then starts selling his left knee, and Schiavone instantly calls it an old Hollywood blonde trick where they would play possum and pretend to be injured when they're fine. And this leads to Steamboat chasing Austin around the ring, then into a sleeper spot in the ring. See a roll up by Steamboat for a two count. And then Schiavone with his newest slogan for WCW says, WCW, what the world is watching now. Not to be confused with the WWF's previous slogan of what the world is watching.
Yeah, sure.
The funny part was, Schiavone said this as they were doing this big crowd shot with complete silence. Like, you could not hear anything here. Austin then sends Steamboat to the floor, and Steamboat rolls down each step as he makes his way to the floor. Just looked that much more painful. And then there was a long spot by Steamboat working on the arm of Austin. We see a catapult by Steamboat that sends Austin into the turnbuckle and then falls into a roll-up by Steamboat. I always love that near-fall spot. It's just the crowd always gets into it when you do that catapult and the roll-up. Steamboat then hits an up kick with both feet here off of his back, which sends Austin down. Then Steamboat uses the stun gun, which is Austin's move, a guillotine on the top rope, and then hits a chop from the top rope and delivers more punches on top of Austin. Then Austin tosses Steamboat over the top rope, skins the cat, and Schiavone says it would have been a DQ if Steamboat hit the floor. Oh. What? Austin threw him over the top, regardless of how effective he was. The intent was to throw him over the top rope.
It's a really stupid rule that I
God, guess I'm glad they got rid of it eventually.
They just all wanted to ignore it.
They both then go for tombstones, but they're constantly reversed, and it ends with Steamboat hitting the most safe tombstone ever. And the crowd is into it. Steamboat comes off the top rope, and Austin tosses the referee, and Steamboat then begs the referee not to disqualify Austin because he wants to win the title. And Steamboat hits a mid-ring crossbody. It's reversed. Austin lands on top. Steamboat kicks out at two. Then Austin puts his feet onto the ropes and pins him for three. Not the most dramatic finish, but a pretty solid match with these two. They went about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I thought it was solid. I like the finish. I thought it was nice and surprising and quick. So the feud continues, it looks like.
Yes, until Steamboat would retire a few months later and then be fired in September.
Oh.
Mike Tenay and Chris Cruz are interviewing Paul Orndorff and Paul Roma backstage for the hotline. Oakland is then backstage in the locker room of Arn Anderson and the party going on with the stud stable, a bunch of women and drinks. Funk cuts a funny promo pretending to cry, being Dustin Rhodes. Then Colonel Parker has a toast with everybody and announces Anderson joining the stud stable. And then Anderson cuts a promo about being in a hospital in London a year ago. Didn't mention why with the Sid Scissor incident. And said he will do anything that helps himself. Rhodes made a pact with the devil. And Oakland ends this by saying, ladies, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Arn is in the middle of this pretty good promo. And then out of nowhere, these fuckers pour champagne all over his head. Right over the top of his head.
Well, They're initiating him into the stud stable.
It completely threw him off. I would be so pissed if I'm in the middle and concentrating on this very emotional promo, and all of a sudden you tossed a drink on my head.
Well, I was just happy that Oakland didn't refer to these women as skanks.
Oh no, that's like 17 years down the road.
Yes. Then we go to our next match for the tag titles. Kevin Sullivan and Cactus Jack defending the titles with Dave Sullivan in their corner. Defending against Pretty Wonderful, Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff. Paul Roma, for those of you that never saw him in the WWF or WCW, you can probably see this guy at any high-end nightclub on a Friday or Saturday night. There's so many of them.
There are tons of Paul
This Romans. Guy was another Scott Putski candidate.
Yeah.
Ripped to shit. And, you know, even Orndorff at this point. I mean, was up there in age. But, my God, the shape this guy was in. And Dave Sullivan is wearing a Hulk Hogan t-shirt. And the match starts really slow with Orndorff and Roma out-wrestling the brawlers. And then they kind of, like, tease that Sullivan and Jack are kind of reluctant partners, but they work the whole match together, and there's no dissension. Sullivan knocks both heels, takes their heads and knocks them into the turnbuckle, and Heenan says, "Hey, Hank Aaron, that's a real doubleheader."
Good.
And there was this weird dynamic throughout the match where the faces had the heat for the majority of the match.
Mm-hmm.
It was like they were working as the heels, but they were the baby faces. And Schiavone brings up that, "Oh, ladies and gentlemen, the wave has begun here," which my understanding has always been when the wave breaks out at a wrestling show, it's because people are bored.
I don't know what it was, but Foley seemed to, like, he seemed to react to this by just keeping the hold and not really doing anything.
I think he was noticing that the crowd wasn't sitting on their hands. And Sullivan delivers a punch, and Roma sells it by going over the top rope, again ignored. Jack then hits a double-arm DDT to Orndorff, and it leads to Dave Sullivan getting involved, and the heels then get the advantage on Jack. Roma pulls down the legs of Jack as Orndorff pins him. The ref doesn't see the interference, and Pretty Wonderful win the tag titles in a lackluster match, I thought.
Yeah, it really felt like a, you know, real nothing match with just guys doing moves. I didn't really feel attached to anybody here. I just felt no...
Like,
no
Jack was like an afterthought in this match.
Yeah.
And really forgotten in this tag team.
It felt really long, too, this match.
And I don't think it was that long either, but certainly felt it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Schiavone hypes up the main event as a dream match for everyone. Heenan says he knows Hogan better than anyone. He's not excited about Hogan coming in. And Schiavone says this is going to be the greatest match ever. These two were clearly told kill time because they kept looking at each other and just going off into different comments and tangents. Right, this went like 3 minutes of them basically saying the main event's next.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Stretch. Then Michael Buffer's in the ring. He introduces WCW Commissioner Nick Bockwinkel. And then out comes Shaquille O'Neal with them. And then we get the introductions of the participants. Ric Flair comes out with Sherry. Hulk Hogan's out with Jimmy Hart and Mr. T. And the match begins. Flair defending the WCW title in Hogan's debut. And the match starts off with Flair bumping around for Hogan. Hogan then, he tried his version of like the spinning cross armbar that we see Alberto Del Rio do. But this was, you know, pre-MMA education. And did you notice the technique of this armbar?
Well, I've seen guys do it this way before where they're
not push off the side of the guy with their feet.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen that. I've seen it done that way before.
Hey, for Hogan to be doing anything different, I was amazed.
Yeah. This was
his New Japan reference because he's worked in Japan. Yeah. He knows how to hurt people.
Yes.
And Flair then gets to the floor, hides behind Sherry. They try a wrestling sequence here with Hogan getting the better of Flair, and this looked really bad. I mean, Hulk Hogan doing like amateur wrestling. Just picture that, everyone, and it was worse. Flair gets the advantage in the ring with chops and shots to the body. Then Hogan is chopped and goes over the top rope. And it ends in a DQ. No, it does not. Sherry then gets a chair. The referee sees the chair, but this is not a disqualification. And the chair is stopped by Jimmy Hart grabbing the chair from Sherry. And it leads to Flair hitting Hogan in the back of the head and keeping the heat. Hogan then comes back with his own chops and the crowd is into the comeback. Then Hogan went for a double leg takedown. This must be seen. This is like an animated like GIF waiting to happen. This double leg was horrible. Flair just ends up in a side control out of this and uses the ropes for a one count. Flair then applies a reverse choke spot to wear down Hogan. Schiavone mentions that that Jimmy Hart is yelling into the Hulkaphone. The Hulkaphone. And way too many crowd shots in this. They went to these long fucking panning shots. It was like the first time they had filled an arena, you felt like. Like, look at all these people at our event. It was like three times in this match.
Well, I felt like they wanted to capture the atmosphere of this big, big match. And, you know, like the crowd sounded quite
amazing.
They
were into Hogan.
Yeah.
They were certainly into Hogan.
I definitely got the feel that this was like a big type of match, like a WrestleMania level type of match, and I guess they're trying to complement that with the shots as well.
We see Hogan fight back to his feet, hits a vertical suplex from the apron, but then misses the leg drop. Flair goes for the figure four, but Hogan counters with a roll up for a two count, and the crowd pops for the near fall. Hogan then blocks another figure four, and Heenan here mentions that Hogan hasn't wrestled for 2 to 3 years in 94.
Yeah, not true.
No. Hogan then powers up, hits the big boot, but Sherry pulls out the referee and then attacks Jimmy Hart. Flair then delivers a low blow. Sherry goes to the top rope and hits a splash on Hogan, and then a figure four is applied as Nick Patrick replaces Randy Anderson. Sherry then chokes Hogan after Hogan reaches the ropes from the figure four, and Flair continues to work on the left leg at this point. We see the Hulk up spot as Flair attacks. Hogan no sells, but then he runs into a back elbow from Flair. Sherry misses another splash. The ref is watching all of this, by the way. Flair is then tossed off the top rope, his typical bump, and then Hogan clotheslines Flair, then punches Sherry in the face.
Good.
All right. Hogan then applies a figure four, which also looked bad. Sherry gets on the apron, but Mr. T takes her away. Then Flair grabs some brass knucks, clocks Hogan, but Hogan kicks out of the pinfall attempt. He hulks up. It leads to the big boot and leg drop for the win. Crowd goes nuts, and I thought Heenan really sold the finish well here. He was just so upset that Hulk Hogan has come into WCW and won the title.
Yeah.
And there was a fireworks display. Shaq presents the title to Hogan. And Heenan says he doesn't even want to watch the replay. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, what did you think of this? Having, this was Hulk Hogan's first match and you put the title on him right away. Do you think it was the smart move to make?
I thought it was fine. I mean, I guess they could have drawn this out a little bit longer for another show. But I guess they just wanted to, you know, show that this was a new era and they wanted to make the change immediately. I actually thought this match was good. I liked, anytime you have a crowd that is this hot, they can make any match, you know, worth it. And this was like a typical Hulk Hogan match. And the crowd was really behind.
I would say it was, you know, Hulk tried a lot more offense than you typically, like, he was trying different stuff,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure was stuff that, you know, he had been working with New Japan for the past year at this point, and I think he was trying to incorporate a bit of that repertoire into this. Didn't really work for me because, I mean, this guy is a very awkward performer when it comes to wrestling.
Yeah.
But Flair just playing super heel in this match, and the crowd heat was just huge. Like, they wanted Hogan to win, and I agree with the decision. I'm just wondering if, was the draw here Hogan-Flair, or was it just simply Hulk Hogan coming to WCW, where you could have got that match and built to a Hogan-Flair match for the title and gotten two pay-per-views out of it?
You could be right.
Then we see Hogan walking backstage, and he's just, this is like right out of the J-Cup way. Where Hogan is just talking to himself, saying, holy moly, yeah. And he goes into a dressing room. He's interviewed by Gene Okerlund, and we see Pillman, Bischoff, Jim Duggan in the back. And Hogan just cuts a big promo about all the guys involved. He name drops all these countries that he wants to go to, including Afghanasia. And then we go back to Tony Schiavone and Heenan at ringside. Heenan storms off and is upset, and that's how the pay-per-view ends. So, you know, crowd, they came to see Hulk Hogan, and they got what they wanted on this show. And, this was a very strong crowd in Orlando for a lot of stuff. There were some matches they were kind of sitting on their hands, but for the main event, they were really, really into it.
Yeah, exactly what they were expecting, you know. I give the show about maybe a 4 out of 10. I just wasn't too interested in too many of the people involved, and none of the matches were really too amazing. Even a Steamboat in Austin, I thought, was a little disappointing, actually.
Yeah, I gave it a 5 out of 10. I enjoyed certain performers on this show. I thought Regal looked really good on this show. The tag match was definitely below expectations. Crowd heat was really strong for the main event, but, you know, this was far from the best show you've ever seen. So that was our thoughts, everyone, on Bash at the Beach. At this point, where would you like to go right now? Way, we can go feedback. We can do our interview.
Let's go to Jimmy.
All right. We spoke with Jimmy Hart about this specific event, and also want to ask him a bit about the passing of Randy Savage. We haven't talked to Jimmy since that passing occurred, and he has a really interesting story about how he found out about Savage passing away back in May. So here we go, Jimmy Hart chatting about WCW's Bash at the Beach in 94 and some other topics here with myself and Wei Tim. Returning to the program, it's one of our favorite people to chat with. He is the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, a WWE Hall of Famer, legendary manager, and we're going to be chatting about a number of topics with him. But a pleasure right now to welcome back to the program, Jimmy Hart. And how are you doing today, Jimmy?
Man, I am great, man. You know what? Every day I look in the mirror and go, I pinch myself and go, do I really get paid for doing this crazy business of wrestling all these years? I love it. I love it.
Well, you've always called yourself the Dick Clark of professional wrestling, and why don't you give fans a bit of an update right now? I know you have a lot of projects on the go, specifically with the WWE, but what's coming up this summer for Jimmy Hart?
Well, WWE, I just got back this past week in New Orleans doing WrestleMania Reading Challenge, and then also the week before I was wearing a tie up for the WWE, Jim Neidhart's daughter, part of the Hart Foundation. We were at L.A. doing a little meet and greet for Comcast, you know, so... you know, just everything's getting geared up for the big John Cena match with the Rock coming up at WrestleMania this year. But you know what I'm looking forward to? I'm looking for the pay-per-view in Chicago when CM Punk faces John Cena. What a great Raw show Monday night. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but what a lot of swerves and curves, huh? It was great.
Yeah, what did you think of the promo on Raw, Jimmy? I mean, that was kind of something that's definitely got a lot of people talking, both inside professional wrestling and outside of it as well. Lots of attention that I agree. It's really added a lot of interest for this Money in the Bank pay-per-view in Chicago.
Oh, absolutely. But just what you said, it got a lot of attention. And this is what this business is about. You know, with so much stuff going on in everybody's lives and what all's taking place in the world. And for them to sit down on a Monday night, the ratings have just been tremendous. But, I mean, it really kept me watching every minute of this, you know, on the TV. And the last couple of weeks have been phenomenal. They really have.
Now, one of the reasons we want to have you on here, Jimmy, is that each week we kind of take a look back at a historical event and kind of look at some of the interesting details going on at the time. And this week we were taking a look at another very big pay-per-view that took place in July, and that was the 1994 Bash at the Beach, where yourself and Hulk Hogan joined the company. And we just want to ask you a couple of questions about the event, with the first one on a lot of people's mind is just how, in fact, Jimmy Hart and Hulk Hogan began discussions with WCW. I mean, how did the ball get rolling here for what ultimately culminated with his debut at that Bash at the Beach event with Ric Flair?
Well, what really happened is Hulk had taken time off to go out and do Thunder in Paradise from the WWE, and I went with him, of course, and we were on the set at WWE up at Disney. We were on the set of Thunder in Paradise at Disney World, and Eric Bischoff and them had been filming some of their TV shows there. And so he came by to see us, and the next thing you know, Hulk and I were on our way down to Atlanta, Georgia, for Ted Turner to sign a contract, and that's how it really all took place. It was just kind of just fell into place. It was nothing pre-planned, predetermined. It just happened to, something just fell into place back then. And so, you know, we spent our years down there doing that and had a good time, you know, and going down there. Had a lot of great stars down there, and back in the time, though, they were doing most of their TVs at center stage, so I always felt like, and I think Hulk did too, that, you know, center stage was great, but you just don't get the impact from a building that holds 1,000 or 1,200 people, that big look that you really need to have that when we came from New York that we had at the time, you know. And I was excited because at the last year we were kind of there, I got a chance to do, Eric had given me a chance to do about 6 months, do the Saturday night show, the 605 show. Mm-hmm. And I had a thrill doing that because I got to use some people they wasn't using at the time, like Rey Mysterio and Booker T and, oh my gosh, just, you know, Chavo Guerrero, Eddie Guerrero, just so many of those guys I was able to use, and Benoit. I mean, and also Jericho that nobody was able to use at that particular time. So after we started using them on the Saturday Night Show, they finally moved them up to the big, you know, the shows that they had at the time down there, Nitro and everything. But it was just a thrill for me. It really was.
Prior to that meeting, Jimmy, what discussions did you and Hulk have about, you know, the potential of going to WCW? What were your opinions of WCW before that, and did you ever, you know, consider this move prior to that meeting?
Well, you know, it really wasn't. I mean, I don't know what Hulk was thinking, but my whole thing, I mean, I loved being with WWE, with WWF back then at the time, and you know, what happened to me is I had so many people I'd managed. I mean, I'd had King Kong Bundy. I had, you know, starting off with King Kong Bundy and Greg Valentine, then Bret Hart, then Night Hart was added with us, vice versa. And then I had the Hart, I had the Russo brothers, Gino Bravo, Adrian Adonis, Earthquake, Typhoon, Danny Davis, the wrestling referee, the Honky Tonk Man, Terry Funk, Dory Funk. I mean, just the list just went on and on and on and on, the Nasty Boys. And all of a sudden, it's almost like I ran out of people to manage, you know, and I switched in at the last year I was there, for WrestleMania, I believe 9 or 10, I'm not quite sure. I was managing Hulk and Brutus. And all of a sudden, when Hulk left to do this other, it was just kind of timing for me maybe to step out of the limelight for a while, because what a great opportunity I had up there. I had a chance doing music and managing some of the greatest names ever in this business. And thank gosh, you know, 5 or 6 of them are already in the Hall of Fame. And it was just a dream come true for me, coming from Memphis, Tennessee, of course. And so there was really no big plan to go with anybody. We were just down there doing Thunder in Paradise, and I was working with Hulk doing Mr. Nanny and some other shows doing promoting. And all of a sudden, everything just kind of fell into place.
And with that first show, Jimmy, I mean, you got a giant impact right off the gate with not only Hulk Hogan, it was all centered around his debut match, but I mean, bringing back Mr. T, Shaquille O'Neal in Orlando, you know, you had Hank Aaron in the crowd. It was really presented as a big deal. And to me, it was an event for WCW that it was kind of saying that, you know, we can contend at this level, which I think up until that point, a lot of people had seen kind of them in the number two position. And you saw them try and, you know, take it into the next gear with that show and making a big statement with that first show.
Well, you know what happened too is Hulk just pulled a lot of favors, because we knew Shaquille anyhow and were big fans of his. And so Hulk just asked favors from everybody. He called Mr. T And at the time, Eric, you know, they were kind of in a situation down there. They had great talent, but they were kind of in a stalemate. You know, not really, the numbers weren't really knocking anybody out or the house shows either. And so I think they were at a kind of a make it or break it situation. That's why he was able to bring Hulk in at the time. And so we pulled every favor we had and just tried to convince Mr. Turner, Ted Turner, and Eric that, hey, if you're going to compete with WWE at WWF at the time, you know, you've really got to make it something that people really are going to be excited about other than just a wrestling match. And so we used a lot of favors from a lot of people, but it really worked. And I think that's what really kicked off getting the budget they needed to try to be competitive.
And do you have any recollections, Jimmy, of refereeing the match with the hosts of the Ron and Ron radio show, which was on prior to the pay-per-view going live?
Well, you know what? I there were so many things that we talked about doing that, had that happening. But also, I remember fighting Man Cow up in Chicago, which
yes.
Almost forgot my neighbor. Bubba the Love Sponge down in Tampa with Chris Jericho and Randy Savage in his corner, Jericho in my corner at the time. So, we did so many things back then that WCW really had never done before. I mean, I'd do a thing for Jimmy Hart. A lot of the shows would go out and challenge a lot of the DJs, you know, stand up or shut up. And a lot of the house shows we worked on that before the shows and stuff to help draw those crowds and to help get a little extra interest into it. But, you know, it was just a lot of fun down there doing everything. And then, of course, later on, working with everybody was great, but and then a lot of our guys that we'd worked with WWF back then, you know, had started coming in down there. Ted DiBiase and Bret Hart, of course, and Nash and Hall and X-Pac and everything. So it was just something that timing was so right for everything at the particular time. But, you know, looking back on it, it was a great thrill. But that's why I'm so thrilled to start doing stuff back again with WWE, because when you look at the production, and that's the one thing that we had talked about Ted Turner and Eric back then, production is so, so important. And of course, when you watch a WWE project with Kevin Dunn and his crew doing it,
yeah,
it's just hard to beat that production. But I don't care who you hire, who you've got, it's just phenomenal.
I'm curious on the promotion side, Jimmy, both in WWF and WCW, of how closely you worked with the late Zane Bresloff, because he's a name that I think a lot of people don't really know, but had a huge impact behind the scenes, and I imagine that you two probably worked quite a lot over the years together.
Well, I was working hand-to-hand with Zane at the particular time, and he loved wrestling just the same way I do. He reminded me of Andy Kaufman, because Andy Kaufman back in Memphis loved wrestling so much. But we both would eat, sleep, and every day we'd talk on the phone, talk on the wrong promotion. I've got to tell you a quick story. Back when we did the pay-per-view in Chicago, right at the last minute, they were going to pull the match with me and Man Cow. And Brother Zane called Eric, and he said, let me tell you something. He said, you pull this match with Jimmy Hart and him. He said, you know what tickets were sold? And I'm not trying to put myself over. I'm just saying, telling you what was really happening at the thing. He said, let me tell you what. This was our ticket advance going in. Once we added Man Cow and Jimmy Hart and had that month of publicity of Jimmy on the radio every morning of them back and forth and with Man Cow's following too, he said, look what the tickets jumped to money-wise. He said, so if you pull this off, he said, we might as well not ever run this again. So, buddy, they put that match back on really, really quick. But he just saw things a lot different. You know, Eric at the time hated tag teams. He broke up when he broke up the Hart Foundation down there, the Russo brothers, the Nasty Boys, the Steiner brothers, you know, because he never liked tag teams, which is fine. I'm not knocking. I'm just saying everybody has an opinion. But I think that hurt a lot back then, and Zane was against that. He said, this is part of wrestling, because tag teams are part of wrestling, you know. I think Eric wanted to dress everybody in black and call them by their real names. You know, once again, I'm not saying anything bad. I'm just, everybody has an opinion of what they like and don't like, and Zane fought against that. He said, this is crazy. People like the Hitman Hart, the names, Mouth of the South Jimmy Hart, you know, the Nature Boy Ric Flair, and that's all part of this business, is being colorful. And so it's just, you know, the way things were. So, but we always fought for that. We didn't get it done, but we fought for it.
Jimmy, can you tell us about the creation of Hulk's WCW theme that he came out to, American Made?
Yes, we needed a song for down there, because we couldn't use Real American or any of that. And so Eye of the Tiger. And so we wrote a song called American Made. So we used it for 6 years before he really jumped over to the NWO. And so we had an album out called Hulk Hogan and the Wrestling Boot Traveling Band, and it did real well for us on Select Records back at the time. So we had that off an album that we did. And a quick story here: I don't know how many people really love American Idol. I do, but Hulk and I went to Europe for a tour with this album. While we were over there, a friend of ours set up a meeting with a promotion man over there, and he said, look, a promotion man would like to talk to y'all about this album, but he's got an idea for a Hulk doing a song over there. So we went to see this particular promotion man, and while we went there, he loved the album, but he said, look, I've got a deal for y'all, Jimmy. He said, if y'all go in and cut this single, it's called The Leader of the Gang by Gary Glitter. He said, I think Hulk would have a number one album. We'll cut the video on it. We'll cut the song. The album was, the song was number one for 4 weeks. They did cut a video that was great, and the guy who made the deal for us was Simon Cowell. Can you believe that?
Wow.
And he loved wrestling, because all he talked about, he said, Jimmy, he said, I love to be in a heel. He said, I love the way you can insult the people and do this and everything. I'm sitting here going, is this guy for real? But he said, look what happened to him later, one of the mainstays of American Idol. But that's a true story.
Wow. That says a lot. I mean, I didn't know he was a wrestling fan, but it certainly says a lot about how he used to perform on a show. I'm curious, Jimmy, does Hulk still play the bass at all, or any type of instrument?
You know what? I'm not sure. I think once in a while, since his back's better now, I'm sure he might pick up the bass and play a little bit. You know, his daughter sings and everything, and probably does it. But back when we do some of our concerts, you know, Honky Tonk Man, myself, Coco Beware, and Hillbilly Jim, we kind of put the thing called the Legends of Rock and Wrestling. We've got a few little things coming up in the near future. But I remember for the WrestleMania we had in Orlando, myself, Jerry Lawler, Mean Gene, and Hillbilly Jim had an outdoor concert, and we drew 5,015 people, believe that or not, which was a great deal at wow. $10 a head for our big charity thing that we had there for the Chamber of Commerce. And we did some of the Gentry hits, and Lawler and us did, and of course Mean Gene did Tutti Frutti, and Hillbilly did Waking Up Along and Don't Go Mess With a Country Boy. But I was able to do Eat Your Heart Out, Rick Springfield, and some of our Gentry stuff. So, but I love the music, and that's one thing about WWE. They always gave me a chance to do the music, and WCW did too. You know, we did the Nitro Girl stuff and Honky Tonk stuff when he was there for the short run, and Diamond Dallas Page, and the Nash and Hall's Wolfpack stuff. So me and my partner were able to do some of that stuff too. So I've always kind of dabbled in music a little bit, which I've been so grateful that the WWE, Vince McMahon and them, gave me a chance to really do.
Now, as we wrap up the Bash at the Beach chat, Jimmy, I just wanted to ask you as well, and obviously we don't have to get into the specifics, but during that summer, of course, there was the huge trial that Vince McMahon was involved in, and Hulk Hogan was linked to that too. And working so closely with Hulk, was it a difficult time for him in that he's trying to take this next step in his career while still having all this coverage during that summer at the same time? It was very much, I'm sure, very conflicted, and I mean, you would probably know better than anyone kind of what Hulk's mindset was during that summer. It was definitely very difficult, I'm sure, for him.
Well, it was, but he knew in the end he was just going to tell the truth, and that's what he did. And so, but it was kind of crazy. You know, anytime you, just by watching this Casey Anthony thing every day, you know, yeah. I'm not involved at all on it, but I'm tense every time a verdict's given or anything happens. I find myself biting my fingernails, and I'm like, and I'm not even involved in it, but it's just something that takes place. But, you know, Hulk went through a lot. Everybody did at the particular time. The whole wrestling world did, really. But, you know, everything came out great. You know, Vince was not guilty. Of course he wasn't. And Hulk just told the truth. And, you know, and so it all worked out in the long run. And then back and forth, both of us have been back from time. I'm kind of like a pimple on prom night. It's hard to get rid of Jimmy Hart, you know. Every time somebody tries to get rid of me, they go, well, let's bring Jimmy in to do promotion. But that's what I love so much about being with the WWE now. I'm able to go to these cities and do promotion for them and everything, and I just love it. And I just came back. I was in Winnipeg, not too far from y'all guys.
One province over.
Yeah, for Bob Holliday. Several months ago, I was able to do a little thing at some of the shows over there and be part of it. The fans are just great. I always go out and do the autographs and stuff. And the National Guard, you know, my son Jimmy Hart Jr. just finally got out of the service and everything, but he spent 6 years overseas in Afghanistan and
wow.
and Iraq and everything, and I was able to go over there a couple of two or three trips. So, you know, just to be part of this business still and be part of meeting and greeting the fans, whether it's in the airport or anywhere, it's been great. By the way, I'm coming up in August. I'm doing a little personal appearance with Neidhart down in I believe it's the NWA convention, which is going to be down in Atlanta this year in August. I think 5th and 6th. We're going to be doing autographs down there and stuff and having fun with that. And like I said, I'm still keeping this dream alive, baby.
And before we let you go, Jimmy, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people over the last 2 months have asked you maybe some of your memories of Randy Savage. And I know we haven't had you on the show since he passed away in May. But you probably have a very unique perspective getting to work with Randy in Memphis back when he came over from his from the ICW promotion.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. But this is what's so crazy. That morning that when Randy passed away, I just spoke to Lanny earlier. Lanny and I were on the same show in San Jose that evening for a big wrestling convention out there.
Uh-huh.
And so what happened was for the next day, but what happened was Lanny had called me that morning to get the promoter's name because he had left on an earlier flight and he was stuck in Dallas. And he said, look, my plane's going to be about 5 hours late. Can you give me the promoter's number so I can call him and tell him? So I called Lanny back and gave him the number. About 30 minutes later, Lanny calls me back and goes, Jimmy, you won't believe what happened. He goes, I just heard my brother just got killed in a car wreck. I went, what?
Oh,
I couldn't believe it. So he called me, and I gave him the numbers, promoters and stuff. And then about 3 hours later, when you started hearing on the news and everything, but Randy and Landy in Memphis were just great. Randy was working a promotion against our Memphis promotion at the time, but Jerry Jarrett always said, look, never knock the promotion. He goes, one day, he said, I'm telling you, they'll be back with us. And that's exactly what happened. But I got to manage Randy down there some with Lanny, with Angelo Poffo, his dad, and be part of that. But what a quick story here, too, after doing that with him. When Howard Finkel saw the tapes of me in Memphis, and they were getting ready to do the first WrestleMania, Howard had took the tapes to Vince. Vince saw them. He liked them. So to make a long story short, they called me down there. Well, I was up there for about 6 months and did the first WrestleMania. And all of a sudden, they called me one day and said, look, we'd like to see if Randy Savage would be interested. So I was living in Memphis still at the time. So I called Randy, met him over on Summer Avenue, gave him the numbers and said, hey, the WWE loves you and they want you. So Randy called them, and it got all worked out. So I was kind of part of that little era, too, with Randy and Lanny and them. And they brought Liz in, who at the time was not doing any managing at the time. So I picked them up when they first came up to New York and drove them around throughout the first 2 or 3 weeks. They were on the same car as we were on. So I've had a good connection with them through all the years. I really have.
Yeah, and just a huge loss. And, I mean, one that just went way outside just simply the wrestling world. That was just such a gigantic news story when that took place. And, I mean, it seems everyone had a Randy Savage memory from whether it be childhood or at some point of knowing who the Macho Man was. Just such an iconic figure within professional wrestling. But, Jimmy, always a great time chatting with you. And why don't you tell our listeners what's coming up in the very near future for Jimmy Hart that they can check out, because I know you always have many, many things on the go.
Well, you know what? We've still got a little irons in the fire out there. I just finished a little project in Chicago. It's called Wrestling's Weekend Warriors, and it's about all these kids that are so good in the ring. And, I mean, they're groomed, they're dressed, they can do interviews, and they just do so many great things that shot a little pilot on that with a company called Tribeca Flashpoint, which is owned by Robert De Niro. So haven't door knocked with it yet. Because when the WWE had called me to come back to do WrestleMania, I kind of dropped everything on that. And did a little project, too, called Underground Wrestling, No Freaking Excuses, which is kind of the opposite of the other, which is about some kids that wrestle these little nightclubs around the country. And they are, but they love different characters. One of them loved Dusty Rhodes and just you know, characters like that, which is worked a little project on that. And got the little WrestleLicious projects. We're hanging on by a thread on that sucker, but I still think there's room for a girls' wrestling company. That's what we're kind of putting, you know, trying to put together with a friend of mine named Johnny C. out of Minneapolis, of course. And so working with a little company on merchandising thing, they are doing a lot of stuff called American Classics on merchandise and stuff. So and we still have our XWF project. So hopefully we've got a little thing. You know, we've got 5 episodic adventures on all those XWF tapes that never were seen with Piper and Lawler and Tony Schiavone and Hulk and Bobby Heenan and the Road Warriors and Jimmy Hart and some and Mean Gene and everything. So we still own those tapes. And so we just had a couple of bites recently on a company that might like to air all 5 of those episodic adventures. So everything's good, man. I'm having fun with the WWE back again. I'm getting me some new Jimmy Hart jackets made, but it's great to be part of wrestling. And hey, just remember the big Money in the Bank pay-per-view coming up in a couple of weeks, Sunday. John Cena, of course, against CM Punk. So I'm excited. But thank you guys for calling me. I love doing your show.
Jimmy Hart, the hardest working man in professional wrestling. Mm-hmm.
Always has like five projects on the go at any given time.
So some very interesting stuff there because, you know, he was involved in a lot of the behind the scenes at this point. And a lot of people, they look at, oh, he was the manager of Hulk Hogan like it's just simply an on-air role. But he was very much involved with Hulk Hogan's outside projects, whether it be music or other endeavors. He really was working very close with Hogan at the time. And it really does show just the loyalty and the faith he had in Hogan to leave WWF at the time for WCW.
Mm-hmm.
So took a big gamble on his part going over there. And it was, you know, that was the seeds being planted for what would eventually become a national war between the two companies. And Hogan at the time, you know, he did add some interest on pay-per-view, but really didn't connect as many people thought when it came to house show attendance. And it wasn't really until 96 or so with Savage feuding with Flair, and then later when the NWO came about that you saw house shows really pick up and the whole business of WCW take off. So Hulk Hogan was a huge piece in the puzzle for WCW of people just suddenly taking this company, I won't say taking them seriously, but bringing some curious people to see Hulk Hogan in a different organization.
Absolutely.
So there we go, everybody. Now let's shift over. I want to get into feedback for the show, and
And we'll start from Chris from L.A. as John sets up his feedback. Chris from L.A., what I remember the most about Bash at the Beach 94 was how awful it was, but at least we got a 20-minute classic from Steamboat in Austin. From about late 90 to 94, I was loving WCW. From the Dangerous Alliance to Surfer Sting to Ron Simmons to Rick Rude. By the time Hogan got there, the writing was on the wall for what that company was going to become. As I recall, with the exception of Hogan, every babyface on the card lost. It was almost as if they were blatantly letting the talent know that this was now the Hulk Hogan show. It turned into a place for WWF rejects. Granted, the company achieved most of its success once they got Hogan. I still prefer early 90s WCW, when aside from the uber silly shit like RoboCop and the Cheatham the Midget, they were cutting edge.
Jason Chapa, having been a kid who occasionally caught WCW on their syndicated programming, the only thing that really mattered was Hulk vs. Flair. Why? Because I was drinking the kayfabe Kool-Aid regularly and watched to know if Hulk had recovered from Yokozuna's leg drop, the same leg drop that killed The Undertaker earlier that year. Looking back on the era and having gotten through most of the stellar WCW DVDs that are out now, I've always been bothered that Hogan had to win a title on his first match in. But then, what about Hogan doesn't bother me nowadays? Well, you can criticize it, but I mean, Hulk Hogan was perceived to be a game changer for WCW. This was the guy that was going to get the meetings with companies that would never probably even table wrestling, get them new licensing deals, get them television deals overseas. I mean, he was, you know, he was going to be the face of that company. There was no question about it, and maybe they put the title on him too soon, but that was what they wanted to get to, and that was the road they chose.
Alex Stephanie, this was typical of WCW. Do everything Vince did and do it again. Same angles, same talent, same celebrities. Lastly, how great was young Steven Regal? The fact that he never was world champion while Khali, Arquette, Goldberg, Sid, Luger, Nash, etc. have been is a travesty. I sometimes hate wrestling.
Atish Singh, I also loved WCW from 1990 through 94. When Hogan came in, it turned into the WWF 80s rerun show. Saying that, this pay-per-view is one of the most important in WCW's history. Bringing the biggest star into enemy territory was a gamble, but it was a move that they needed to do. This was like their WrestleMania 1 with all the celebrities, especially Mr. T and Shaq, which was the hottest thing, who was the hottest thing in the NBA at the time. This show had a big fight feel to it, putting the two biggest stars from the past together for a huge clash while both were still in their athletic prime. Yes, it was the tail end of their prime, but they still had it. I loved the pairing of Flair and Sherry together. Sherry was always a great heel for Hogan. My only disappointment was that Hogan didn't atomic drop Sherry like he always did in the WWF. Overall, not a great wrestling pay-per-view, but a great story in the main event and a very important show in the history of WCW and wrestling in general. P.S. Great job on all these reviews, guys. Well, thank you, Atish, and I think that's a very accurate portrayal. Much more story than in-ring on this show. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, if you told me, which would you rather have, a wrestling show that from top to bottom is great in the ring, but you don't have people invested in it? I'd much rather have a show like this where everyone cares, everyone knows at the main event, and they care about seeing it.
Absolutely.
That's the ultimate goal.
Absolutely. Jung Min Kong. WCW was bringing publicity with Ted Turner making a cameo appearance for the Hulk vs. Flair contract signing and Shaq at the event as a special guest timekeeper. WCW wanted a WrestleMania atmosphere with the celebrities and wrestling, but did not make it an annual thing. What was the attendance at this show, John?
I don't know. The Orlando Arena holds...
This is a hockey arena, isn't it? Or a basketball arena, right?
At the time.
Yeah, for the Magic. I mean... Why didn't they run bigger arenas at this time? Bigger, like, stadiums even.
WCW? Yeah. They couldn't fill them.
Yeah, huh?
Their attendance was not that great. This was a bigger crowd for them than usual. There's really? No way. Even with Hulk Hogan coming in, they weren't filling something big. Hmm. I mean, that's the nuts and bolts of it, folks. So, like, WCW was not a tremendous live event company.
I see.
It would be, you know, almost... They definitely had more star power than... I don't know. I don't think comparing them to TNA is really accurate. They did much better television numbers than TNA does right now. Their house shows were comparable to above. And it's like, imagine TNA running a stadium show.
Yeah.
I mean, they were much closer to TNA today than they were to WWF today, you know?
I see.
Thulani, Mabuza, and Cube. It's almost too easy to blame Hogan for all the problems that befell WCW, but by 94, this company was already going nowhere fast. The heydays of the NWA were over. In my opinion, Hogan versus Flair helped rejuvenate interest in WCW. Vince's failure to deliver this match at WrestleMania 8 meant that it was still a match that had huge drawing power. However, after Hogan became champion, the next 2 years of WCW resembled 80s WWF programming. Similar to WrestleMania 14, this was a below-average wrestling show, but an important one with huge historical significance, as Hogan would go on to usher WCW into its most profitable time period. Thanks for reading my feedback, and great job on last week's King of the Ring review.
Alexander Rios. If you think TNA has that history of signing ex-WWE guys and pushing them to the moon, well, WCW did it first and faster than anyone else, with Hulk Hogan winning the world title from Ric Flair on his first day, which to me reeks of a company that had zero faith in homegrown talent. I don't think Sting was quite main event level yet in 94. In fact, was he even on the show? I will give it to WCW, though, because as a company, they're at least growing. After all, Bash at the Beach was the WCW counterpart to SummerSlam, and Nitro was about a year away. Beyond Hogan versus Flair, I can't remember much past Steve Austin versus Ricky Steamboat for the U.S. title.
Move over to Steve Kassan. Hey, leave Bunkhouse Buck alone. In all honesty, and I don't know why, the stud stable of Bunkhouse and Dirty Dick Slater is a personal favorite team of mine. Again, I don't know why, but they are. As for the Bash at the Beach show, being a longtime NWA fan, I will admit that Hogan coming in brought in a lot of attention and made WCW a major player on par with WWF. Because prior to Hogan, WCW was like the CFL to the NFL. Good or bad, Hogan come in, got the wheels turning, and the rest is history.
Mark Cardoso. I never watched this WCW show, but I did remember the promos hyping the show, as Bobby Heenan and several announcers kept hyping it as the big one. When they announced it was Hogan versus Flair, all I could think about was their series of matches in the WWF. I also thought, would Flair be the jobber in this one, too?
Let's go to... Sorry, who's did you just read?
Mark Cardoso.
Okay, Corey Ferreira. For the first time since becoming WCW, the company actually looked important. Bringing in Hulk Hogan at the time, the biggest wrestling star in the world, to be the main guy in your company, WCW made this a huge deal, having Ted Turner show up at the contract signing for the main event, and having Shaq O'Neal show up in Hogan's corner to help the Orlando crowd get behind the Hulkster. Why Shaq? He was... the biggest basketball star in the Orlando Magic. The Flair-Hogan match was fine for their first pay-per-view match, and it paid off for WCW getting a huge buy rate. Best match of the night goes to Steamboat and Austin for another great match in their 94 series of matches.
Trey Davis.
Bash at the Beach 94 will always be remembered as Hogan's first start with the company. As a kid, I always wondered why WWF never had a Hogan Flair match, so when WCW presented it at Bash at the Beach, I was pretty excited. I remember me and my friend hated Hogan and couldn't stand how he never lost any of his matches, and actually cheering for Flair. Months later, my friend's favorite wrestler, Vader, had to job out to Hogan for a few months before jumping to WWF. This made him hate Hogan even worse. Although I was excited for WCW to be contending with the WWF, I was also disappointed Hogan was in WCW because part of the reason I loved it back in the day, was because there were main event guys like Sting, Flair, Rude, Steamboat, who were awesome in-ring workers. Some of the undercard was pretty good from this show, but it was pretty clear that this pay-per-view was centered around WCW signing Hulk Hogan. Overall, from what I can remember, this was a decent show. Thanks for all your hard work entertaining me while I'm at work.
Chad Rivera. I remember when Hulk Hogan joined WCW and my dad told me about it, and it was the first I had ever heard of the promotion. Being six at the time and a former huge Hulkamaniac, the only wrestling I had watched before was the WWF. I was still loyal to the WWF brand, but I started to watch WCW Saturday night whenever I had the chance to. I then saw all the familiar WWF stars that I thought had disappeared off the face of the earth. I begged my dad to order this pay-per-view when it first aired, but being the cheap ass that he is, he didn't want to shell out some extra money for his child's enjoyment since he was planning on ordering SummerSlam the following month. I ended up watching this initially on good old scrambled pay-per-view. I just finished actually watching this for the first time right now. And Chad actually runs down his thoughts on the matches that you can go read up on reviewaway.com in our Bash at the Beach thread, and ends it off with... I thank you guys so much for all you do each week. For a future review, I would like to suggest to continue into shitty WCW with Uncensored 96 or something different and review Kayfabe Commentary's Guest Booker DVD with Jim Cornette rebooking the invasion. Thanks again from Chad Rivera.
John Funk, the very first WCW pay-per-view I ordered because of Hogan and Flair in the main event. Being only 12 at the time, I thought it was the greatest match ever. But looking back now, I can see why the WWF did not book this for WrestleMania 8.
And Nate Milton, Brother Pollock and Brother Ting. The inaugural WCW Bash at the Beach was essentially a two-match show. Even back then, I knew the undercard matches were just filler. This show could have really benefited from the planned Sting-William Regal match, but unfortunately, he was injured at the time. The Austin Steamboat match lived up to expectations, and it was really cool to see a guy that I followed in World-Class Championship Wrestling continue to shine in the big leagues against one of the best of all time. I thought everything about the main event was perfect, except for the finish. Flair and Hogan intrigued me as a fan just for the novelty of seeing them together. Throwing two of the greatest managers ever, Mr. T and Shaq, who at the time was one of the most popular athletes on the planet, and you've got all the ingredients for a good show. Unfortunately, Hogan not only won the match, but he also became the WCW champion. This booking decision really pissed me off as a 16-year-old, as it ushered in a year and a half of Hogan-fueled BS. While I still watched the shows, it wasn't until the Nitro era that I really began loving WCW again. All in all, this was a below-average show bolstered by a couple of good matches. I give the show a 4 out of 10. The same rating as Mr. Ting.
Yeah, wow, we agree. So there you go, John. A lot of people's thoughts on WCW Bash at the Beach. What do you think we'll be reviewing next week?
Well, next week, Wei, I wasn't really sure what we should chat about, but I did get a request for this show, and I thought we would go with the 2003 SummerSlam event featuring the Elimination Chamber. A few people had requested this show, so I thought with us being in the summer now, we could take a look at SummerSlam coming up. So let's review that next week.
Okay.
It features the build-up of this show featured Kane lighting Jim Ross on fire.
Oh, yes.
Yes, that show. So that's going to be coming up. The Elimination Chamber is on that show, as well as Kurt Angle versus Brock Lesnar for the WWE title. So should be an interesting show to go back and review. And as always, everybody, you can join our Facebook group, facebook.com/reviewaway. Like the page, provide your feedback, and interact. Be part of the Review Away community, Wei. It's growing by the day. We are currently at 1,101 people liking us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, of course, join us on Monday nights.
Yeah, tell us, Wei, how people can listen if they've never done it.
Monday nights at 12 o'clock Eastern time. So about, I'd say, for Canadian viewers, half an hour after Raw ends. For American viewers, probably maybe 45 minutes after Raw ends.
just come to the Facebook group and then go to the tab where you'll see on the left-hand side a place where you can click and listen to us right from there. You can chat with the fellow listeners, and it's really cool.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you get to chat live with people as it's happening. You can listen to the show live. There's no more pop-up ads, which is always a positive, as yeah. we've moved over to StickCam. And if you can't stay up that late, no problem, because Tuesday morning the show will be up at liveaudiowrestling.com and on the Facebook group. We always tag it there. So that is what is going to be coming up Monday night, which for many of you is tonight. And if you're listening later in the week, it's coming up in just a couple of days again.
Mm-hmm.
That
is correct.
So, reviewaway.com, liveaudiowrestling.com, and we'll be back Monday night, midnight Eastern time. No, I'm not having one.
What? You got this was we hyped this up, John.
Oh, I'll give my vote.
My vote is
they're terrible.
You don't even know.
I'm not trying one.
Take one.
No, I won't. I'll be sick.
You won't be sick from just one.
Those look disgusting.
You might actually enjoy it.
I can't believe you bought them.
You might actually enjoy it.
No, I'm not trying one.
We promise the people. Right now, the votes are people who like combo snacks, 46. People who don't like combo snacks, 36.
Okay,
so
we'll make it 37.
Well, just try one.
I'm not
John.
Trying one way.
Come on,
I'm
dude.
Serious. I'm not trying.
Why wouldn't you even try it? They're not gonna kill you.
I don't want that going into my body. It looks really gross.
You might like
it. No, I refuse to, dude. I'm a picky eater, man.
Come on.
I'm not
try
eating.
Try one.
Not a chance. Not a chance.
Don't be a sissy.
I would have hated you in high school. You would have been one of those peer pressure motherfuckers.
You and your faux hawk.
My faux hawk. Waiting.
Should do it.
I don't want to say anything.
You should do it.
I should have mentioned, by the way, while you bring up the faux hawk, we tried to get on a representative from GLAAD this week.
They didn't respond. Wow.
Fuckers.
Are you going to have one?
What? A representative on?
No.
If they get back to us.
No,
I'm seriously not going to have
snack.
One, everybody. I'm not.
We hyped this all
no,
week.
No. You hyped up that I would register my vote.
No. I hope that you would do a live taste test on the show.
We're all out of time, unfortunately.
No,
so
I think we are.
No.
We just wasted 17 minutes of the opening of the show talking about some bullshit. You can at least put one of these in your mouth and let the people know what you think. Everybody wants to know.
Not a chance.
What?
I can't eat one of these. They look disgusting.
They taste...
How much shit is in this? Let's look at what goes into this, dude. Okay. Saturated, 4.5 grams of saturated fat.
Oh, big deal.
210 calories.
For a bag.
26 grams of carbs. Is this per
of course
one
not.
Or for the whole thing?
What... When you buy a bag of chips, do they list the nutrition facts per chip?
I don't eat chips either, dude. 90 calories. Contains less than 2% of the daily value of these nutrients. Based on a 2,000-calorie diet. How many people are on a 2,000-calorie diet?
I don't know.
That's more
calories.
Than your recommended intake. NASCAR can have them.
Wow. So you are just...
Oh, yeah. I'm being difficult here.
Sitting out.
Yeah, I am. Combos. Song?
They're not that bad.
Well, why don't you come up with a, What song does this,
they're not that bad, actually.
Thing make you think of? Have you ever had them before?
I have, a long time ago. I think I'm going to change my vote.
You like... you voted that you didn't like them.
Yeah. Combos snacks. They're cool. They're delicious.
All right, a song way.
Oh, I know the perfect song. Let us go with...
You sound disgusting right now.
Let us go with Sergey...
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know your name. But Sergey made a song, basically. And also, Chris Maffei. These guys have just been like making songs for us on the Facebook.
There's a few. There's the Nation of Domination theme.
Yeah, that's
there's
right.
There's the My Time.
Yep.
And there's... The Nesty Boys.
Yes, yes.
So thank you guys for making these.
We can't play out all of them, but if you want to hear them all, come to the Facebook group and look them up. Let's go out with The Nesty Boys by Sergey.
All right, we'll go out with that, and I appreciate everyone's songs. I just want to share this one... You know, I get a lot of random comments on my Facebook wall. The most annoying being, have you heard this with like a wrestling story? But this one took the cake. I know you're probably too busy, what with having to sort out what the hell TNA is thinking half the time. Well, actually all the time. But check out some songs / beats on my iPod. And if you could, let me know what you think.
Okay.
And it's not like songs he's made. It's just songs that he has downloaded to put on his iPod.
Wait. This guy posted on your wall?
On my wall.
So what is he supposed to...
I don't know. I'm supposed to click and listen to all his songs and let him know what I think of his musical tastes.
Okay.
Strange.
Let him know. Are you sure he didn't make them?
I don't think so.
Let me read this. Check out some of the songs beats on my iPod if you could. I'm sure he made these.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah, so...
If they're not random.
Yeah, he made them. They're not just... Yeah, these guys make their songs, so we'll be cutting this part of the podcast
out. We don't cut anything, right? We're not a WCW home video.
Okay.
Let me just play one of these.
Of course he made these.
Okay, it makes... This is called Hello. Some healthy bass. This, what would you use this music for?
Hip hop.
Yeah, but what? Like a video you were putting together. What would be a good,
What do you mean?
Like putting this underneath something. Like
oh.
Some shadow boxing.
Okay. Yeah, some fighting, maybe. A highlight package.
All right, then. Sergey, take us out.
We're the boys. We're the nasty boys.
Ding dong, the bitch is dead.
We're the boys. We're the nasty boys.
When Yokozuna walks in, Donovan remarks, "Whoa!"
He's been waiting for this one.
You could just tell he's salivating at
what question just ran into his head.
The brilliant question he's got lined up. And without fail, before Yoko even makes his way onto the mat surrounding the ring, Donovan lets out the question one more time.
How much does this guy weigh?
We're the boys. We're the boys. We're the boys. We're the nasty boys.
He did these ridiculous ones where it was like a guy would hit a move, and before he was even covering it, Vince would be like,
"It's just headed, it's over, and they're gonna be going to Raw for the tag team, you know."
Before he'd even go for a pinfall. Vince was classic for doing this, where he would get so wrapped up in it that we'd be like,
"He punches him in the face, he's gonna pin him, he's gonna be the new champion."
And he just gets so worked up, and it's like, fucking slow down, he hasn't even pinned him.
That's the hell.
Oh, I hated it. I just hated it.
We're the boys. We're the nasty boys.
Ding dong, the bitch is dead.
We're the boys. We're the nasty boys.
Neidhart! Where is he?
You can't find him.
Do you call your brother Pollock?
All the time. Pollock!
Pollock! Pollock! Pollock.